Good evening. I'd like to call the House Ways and Means Committee to order. Today's April 18th, 2023. Let the record reflect that it is 6:03 p.m. We are in the Davis Room 106 of the State Capitol. Today we have present Representative Gray, Representative Groh, Representative McKay, and myself, Chair Carpenter. Please silence your cell phones. Staff assisting us today will be Kevin Allen with House Records. Thank you, sir, for being here. Zach Lawhorn with the LIO. Thank you for being here. My staff, Kendra Broussard, will serve as the committee aide. Today on the agenda is the first hearing of House Bill 160, Permanent Fund Calculation. And with us today, we have Mr. Ed King to present, I believe, on this bill. Is that accurate? Will you please come forward and put yourself on the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Ed King, staff to Representative McKay. And Mr. Chairman, if it's okay with you, I believe your staff is going to walk through the sectional analysis before we do the presentation.
Okay, then let's do it. Please put yourself on the record.
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter. This is Kendra Broussard, staff to Representative Carpenter. I will go through the sectional analysis. Section 1 changes the POMV draw rate from 5% of the 5-year average market value to the real rate of return times the balance. Section 2 changes market value to balance to conform with the changes in Section 1. Section 3 makes language changes to conform with the changes in Section 1. And Section 4 provides an effective date so that the changes are in place next fiscal year.
Short and sweet. Thank you, Ms. Broussard.
Mr. Chairman, again, Ed King for the record. And I would just point out that the Permanent Fund Corporation has reached out to us and let us know that there are a few technical changes that should be made to this draft of the bill, including the change of the term market value to the term balance. Market value is the more appropriate term that should be used in the bill. And so I would suggest the committee consider that amendment.
Okay. So proceed with your presentation.
Mr. Chairman, the bill is effectively just changing the current percent of market value draw that's in current law from a fixed number at 5% to a variable number that tracks market conditions. And the idea here is that the 5% number being fixed provides more stability in the draw, but it also doesn't adjust if the markets are changing. And so what that means is that if the market underperforms, or if the fund underperforms its expectations, you run the risk of that 5% draw being too high. And if the market does well, if the permanent fund does well and exceeds their targets, then that 5% is actually an underdraw on the fund. And we'll talk more about that as well. So that's the idea here. The term real, when we're using it in this presentation and in this bill, is a reference to inflation adjustment. So real being an inflation adjusted number versus a nominal number, which is not adjusted for inflation.
Please let the record reflect that Representative Allard joined us at 6:04. Please continue.
Mr. Chairman, so I'm moving to slide 3, just some of the issues that this bill is trying to address. And it basically boils down to these 3 points. The first is that the 5% draw rate that's stated in law isn't actually the draw that's being made from the fund. And because of that, if the 5% value is the target of the Permanent Fund Corporation, the draw that's being made is actually under drawing less than is allowed to be drawn. It also doesn't adjust to the market if the market is changing, and then because of that, it does expose the state to risks that it could overperform or underperform. And so we'll get into some numbers, Mr. Chairman. If there are any questions, I can answer them now just mechanically, and then as I walk through kind of the impact of what this legislation would do, I can answer questions throughout.
I see no questions. Let's move on.
So on the first point, Mr. Chairman, the current draw rate is less than stated. So the current law says that the POMV, the percent of market value draw, is 5% of the market value. But when you actually look at the draw and compare it to the balance of the fund, you'll find that the percentage that's actually being drawn is less than 5%. And that's continually happening. Anytime that the fund is growing, that's always going to be the case. And you just kind of illustratively, if you're standing in the middle of a hill, right, you're the average height of the hill. The top of the hill is always in front of you. So if the fund is growing, the average is always less than that top. And because of that, your draw is always less than the 5% stated value. The effect of that is shown on slide number 5. So you can see the effective draw of the POMV. So the 5% value is that dashed line. And you can see that the effective draw that we would have had going backwards retroactively is consistently below that 5% number. And that is because the fund continues to grow. So, Mr. Chairman, the first kind of step in taking this discussion a little bit further is to say, well, what if it was an actual 5% draw? So the way that you would do that is rather than doing a draw based on the five-year average value of the fund, you just do it based on the current value of the fund, the market value in the most recent completed fiscal year. And what you'll see is that because the draws are higher than what the current fixed draw amount allows, your allowable draws on the fund are higher as well. And consequently, you're not saving as much money in the ERA. And I would point out, Mr. Chairman, that the inflation proofing is already happening in these graphs. And so you're already doing an inflation proofing to the principal of the fund. So if the ERA is growing, it's growing in addition to inflation proofing. And so what you can see is that based on the current projection of 7.05%, if you were to draw a full 5%, the ERA balance would be stable. It would no longer be growing. And that's just because the 5% number is the target for the fund. So the consequence of that, Mr. Chairman, is, I mean, who is against saving money, right? Like, growing our savings accounts is a good thing. The problem is that when we communicate that we are in deficit to the markets, the investors, the credit raters, everybody that's looking at Alaska and hearing us say that we're in deficit is imagining that we're taking draws from our budget reserves, when in actuality what we're doing is spending the revenues that are generated from the fund. And so because the draw is below the actual performance, it's forcing the fund to grow. And so, for example, in 2020, you can see that our savings accounts grew by about $16 billion, while at the same time, the vernacular in the building was that we were in deficit. And that conversation continues to this day, just because the words that we use in this building mean something different to the people on Wall Street. So, Mr. Chairman, the second point was that the fixed rate POMV doesn't actually track performance. So this graph here shows, going back based on a 20-year average rate of return, what those allowable draws would be. So based on the average rate of return, you can see that the allowable draw that is sustainable is actually above 5%. And that was the case all the way up until the market crashed back in about a year ago. Actually, in 2018, we started to see some of the good years from 20 years prior falling off, and so you do see it start to decline. I would also just point out that these values are based on arithmetic means and not geometric means. Geometric means are the more appropriate measure, but it was a little bit more confusing for me to try to explain that to you. But in your fiscal note from the corporation, they point out that they would use a geometric mean, which is appropriate. So the numbers would be a little bit slightly different than this. Oh, okay. I thought I saw a question. So the green line on the top is the average nominal rate of return, again, not adjusted for inflation. So this is what the fund actually earned over the 20-year period prior to each of these years. And you can see that the returns are consistently over 8%. There was a period of time when the 20-year average dropped down below 7%. But now, because of the good year in 2020, that average has increased. But now we're seeing the decrease in the last 2 years, so it's sliding down again. The difference between the average and the nominal is the inflation adjustment, which is part of the reason why we're seeing that downtrend, is because inflation now is high compared to the last 20 years. Slide number 9 takes it one step further, and it just says, okay, so if we were to go to a real rate of return rather than a fixed rate of, a variable draw instead of a fixed percentage draw, what would that look like? And what you see on the left is what happens to the amount of money that's allowed to be drawn from the ERA to go into the general funds. And on the right, you can see what happens to the balance as a result. And so you see that same upward sloping line for the ERA under the current formula. And then what you're seeing on the other line is that the formula is adjusting to the market conditions. And so since the average rate of return has actually been above 7%, if the next several years were at 7%, you're going to see the real rate of return actually dropping down. And the consequence of that is that in the later years of this, after you have several years of the 7% return, it forces you to draw less out of the ERA in response to the underperformance of the fund. Mr. Chairman, the reason why that this is important at all is because of the risk that having a fixed draw rate exposes the state to. And so I'll talk about those briefly here as well. So the first risk is that the market does well and that the fund actually overperforms its expectations. And so just increasing it by one percentage point, so assuming that the actual returns are more like 8%, like they have been historically, rather than 7%, like we're forecasting, you can see that the difference between the 5% draw versus the adjusting draw. And in most of the years, the draw rate's relatively similar. But in those period between 2031 and 2035, you can see that the 5% draw isn't allowing you to take the full sustainable amount out of the fund because the fund has overperformed. You do notice that in 2043, that's what happens when that 30% return year drops off of the 20-year average. So at the end, you do see that decrease. That's the consequence of that year falling off of the balance and all of the other years being that 8% return. So for the most part, what you can see is that if the fund is performing well, we can draw more, or we can save that money and turn it into a bigger balance that earns a bigger return. The policy decision is really just that opportunity cost, that trade-off that the legislators would like to make on whether it's more important to increase our savings account or whether it's more important to use that money in the current to satisfy current budget needs. The risk in this situation is that you can get into a situation where there are plenty of revenues to balance the budget, but that fixed draw doesn't allow us to utilize them. And then that forces us to have conversations about cutting the budget or implementing taxes, even though there are enough revenues to balance the budget. In the other direction, we also have the risk that 5% draw is actually too high. And so if the fund underperforms and we only earn something more like 6%, what you see is that in either case, the ERA will run out in less than 10 years. And there's two points that are kind of important here. The first point is you can see on the left as the draws are lower because of the lower returns than the current 5% draw allows. But in 2034, you'll notice that on the right, the ERA balance goes to zero. And then on the left, in 2034, you'll notice that there is still a draw from the ERA going to the general fund. And that's really because it's part of this narrative that is a little bit misleading in the building that once the ERA goes to zero, that there is no money left. And that's not actually accurate because there's always money going into the ERA from the principal of the fund. So even if the ERA does go to zero, you do still get the draw. It's just limited to the earnings that are actually made. The other point that you'll notice that when you do have these lower returns, the adjusting real rate of return forces you to reduce that draw and recognize that you're not making your targets, and then it allows that fund to regrow and resume that inflation proofing. The other point that I would make, Mr. Chairman, is that the only reason why the fund is driven to zero in this situation is because the draws from the ERA to the general fund are not the only draws on the fund. There are also draws from the ERA to the principal account to account for the inflation of the principal. And so if you think about it, that means that we actually have two forms of inflation proofing in current law. We have one that is a transfer from the ERA to the principal. We also have the fact that the POMV draw already accounts for inflation. And so because if we are to follow that POMV, inflation is already baked into the calculation. The transfer from the principal to the principal from the earnings reserve is completely voluntary. It's just a matter of where the legislature wants to hold, which account within the fund the legislature wants to hold the money. And so recognizing that if all we do is get rid of the inflation proofing, the required inflation proofing transfer, so we just allow the inflation proofing to happen within the ERA and let the legislature balance the budget within the POMV, still following the POMV, what you'll see is the account actually does not go to zero. And so part of the problem in the conversations that is happening is because of this inflation proofing. And if we were to do a true POMV structure, the transfer, the required transfer, isn't necessary. And consequently, we also never have to deal with this issue of the ERA running out, or in very few situations does that actually occur. It's also the case that the inflation proofing transfer to the principal account only inflation proofs the principal. The 5% POMV inflation proofs both the principal and the ERA. And so it's really kind of a question, just again, a policy call for you all to make on what is the intent of the legislature. But you can inflation proof the fund while maintaining that accessibility in case the returns are very low. And it would help our ability to speak to Wall Street about our credit because we don't have this looming ERA zero conversation kind of hanging over us. And then, Mr. Chairman, the last slide here is, or the last two slides here is, well, the what if we just didn't do any inflation proofing at all? And I bring that up because of this conversation around what is a draw, what is an appropriate draw, what is an overdraw, and in reality, because the earnings reserve account is filled by definition with earnings from the permanent fund, every dollar in the permanent fund is accessible to the legislature. They are earnings. And they can be drawn. So drawing that fund down to zero is not a budget reserve like our constitutional budget reserve is, where it's meant to balance the budget. It's meant to smooth the account, the draws from the account. And so what that means is that if you don't worry about the inflation proofing, if you're not concerned about that as a legislature, that is, if you have a policy decision that it's more important to fund education and troopers and other things, that's more important than growing the permanent fund to account for inflation. That's a policy call. But that does mean that you could draw the entire nominal rate of return and it would still be sustainable. And I show you that on the next graph. So you can see that you can draw significantly more from the ERA and it can still be sustainable in the sense that the fund is not decreasing. All that's happening is it's no longer increasing in order to keep up with inflation. And Mr. Chairman, those are my comments. I'm happy to take questions.
Representative Groh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I have a number. I guess the first question I have is, where's the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation Board of Trustees? I mean, I'm just surprised, you know, that I don't see them. Maybe I could ask Ms. Broussard, were they asked to come here, or is there a reason?
I did not invite the
okay.
Permanent Fund Corporation
okay.
to come.
Right. So I guess I have several questions is, considering the importance of stability, you know, for both the public perception of the dividend and government spending, is the proposed formula based on this average rate of return expected to be more volatile, less volatile, or similarly volatile compared to the current POMV calculation? How would you state that in a sentence?
Representative Groh, through the chair, the volatility in current law is absorbed within the fund balance. And so the balance is going up and down rather than the draw amounts. The problem is that you can't really be sure that that draw amount is the correct amount. And so you do run the risk that you're either going to grow the fund or reduce the fund. The trade-off there is that if you move to a variable rate that tracks the market, you have to decide between tracking and smoothing. So either you can draw every dollar as it comes in, which would be completely tracking the market, or you can do something a long horizon where you have a smoother effect. So the 20-year effect is a smoothing effect. You can see that there is still volatility. I would point out that although that the POMV does help to stabilize the draws on the earnings reserve and stabilize the earnings, we still have not met the volatility challenge that oil prices bring. And so having a partial solution to the volatility in the earnings reserve without the complete solution, it doesn't actually solve the problem. There is a better solution, but if all we're talking about today is the POMV, this doesn't add volatility. As long as you maintain enough cash reserves to weather that volatility, the effect is the same.
Follow up,
Representative Grove.
Representative Chairman Carpenter. Thanks, Mr. King. What about what would happen to this discussion, and I would like you to comment on the pros and cons of adopting House Joint Resolution 9, of combining the Permanent Fund Earnings Reserve account and the Permanent Fund Principal into a single constitutionally safeguarded account. What would the pros and cons of that approach be compared to this?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Grove, through the chair, the question, I believe that you're – so I don't think that these are substitutes, because the House Joint Resolution 9, I believe, is the POMV, if I'm not mistaken, that someone
– constitutionalizing POMV.
Yeah, and if the constitutional POMV is the 5%, you run into these same problems whether you have an ERA or not. The only difference is that in that situation, it's even more risky for the state, because if you underperform that 5% target, you actually invade the balance, the principal of the fund. And so in that regard, it would make more sense to have something that tracked actual market conditions, if that were to be the case. The difference, though, being, if I go back to three slides, this situation here where you can run out of the ERA balance becomes a non-factor in the constitutional question that you raise with the amendment that was suggested. Because the draws are coming straight from the fund and not being washed through an earning reserve to smooth it out, the draws go directly to the general fund and there is no more earnings reserve. In that case, the state would have to maintain some cash reserves to maintain other volatility cash flow through another savings account, which would be more than likely the constitutional budget reserve.
Follow-up.
And you can have a follow-up, but I'm acutely aware that if we set up a particular system here, that into the future, certain conditions exist whereby we've constitutionalized a number, and therefore we must follow that particular number. And what actually means is we have to take from the corpus in order to meet that number. Most Alaskans would probably not want us to establish a system that would, at some point in time, with certain conditions, erode the balance of the corpus in order to pay dividends or pay government. I think that would probably be something that Alaskans would not want to see happen. Representative Groh.
Thank you, Chair, Mr. Chair. Mr. King, did you do this modeling that was presented here?
Yes, Representative Groh, through the chair, yes.
Okay, thanks. What role, if any, did either the Permanent Fund Board of Trustees Permanent Fund Corporation's Board of Trustees or staff play? Did they play any role in this?
Mr. Chairman, we did reach out to the Department of Revenue and the Corporation for comment, but they haven't modeled anything yet. This was a kind of a fast effort to include this in the conversation before the fiscal plan advanced. So there is still work to do for sure, but we did want to have a conversation. So these slides are illustrative more than they are full analysis.
Okay. Representative Grove?
Thank you, Chairman Carpenter. Have you reached out similarly to the Legislative Finance Division's experts on this question?
Representative Grove, I don't know. I did not personally reach out to them. No.
Okay. Would it be possible have the Legislative Finance Division, the Permanent Fund Board of Trustees and staff, and the Department of Revenue's investment experts to also consider this proposal and prepare some modeling?
It is fully within our ability to ask them to do that.
Okay. Follow up.
Representative Grove.
Thank you. Could you summarize the specific reasons that led you to this approach? I've actually studied this for some time, and I'd just be interested in how this proposal came here in terms of intellectual origins or suggestions or how this arose.
I would just like to say before you answer that, it was a highly technical presentation, mm-hmm. and maybe step back out to the 30,000 foot level and address the why.
Mr. Chairman, I suppose the answer to that question, before I answer that question, I would point out there is a fiscal note from the Permanent Fund Corporation with an analysis on the back, so they have looked at it and have provided some comment if it's helpful to the committee members. In terms of where the idea came from, Mr. Chairman, I was in the Department of Revenue when the PLMB statute SB 26 was passed, and this was part of the conversation whether, you know, in determining whether or what the appropriate draw was. I'm sorry, I was actually at the Department of Natural Resources at the time, but I was in this sphere. And so I was following the conversation, and this was one of the conversations around, you know, what is the right number? The 5% number is what the legislature landed on. But it's more, especially if we're talking about a constitutional amendment, it's more appropriate to have a number that adjusts the actual conditions. At least in my mind, it is. As a professional economist, that is my professional opinion, that it's better to have something that tracks the actual performance rather than relying on the legislature to react after the fact. Once it recognizes that its number is too high or too low, you can never make up for the mistake. You can't go back in time and make the correction. So it's better if the structure just advances adjusts to the conditions of the market in real time.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. King.
Representative Gray, do you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Chair. So can we go to slide 8? I'm wondering, it seems like in general, this new formulation means that we'd actually have more money most of the time. We would have had more money. But then I see like in 2021, the lime green line goes below the red line. Can you explain why that happens there?
There, Representative Gray, through the chair, there's a few things that are going on. So the rate of return is the average real rate of return is based off of both inflation and actual market performance for the last 20 years prior to the year in question. And so what you're seeing there is that in 2021, you had a negative return year on top of a high inflation year. And so your fund balance decreased, which means that the percentage draw is a larger number. And that's also happening. And then on the other end, you also have the number that's falling off. So whatever number that was in 2000, I can't say off the top of my head if that was a good number or bad number, but that's why you're seeing this adjustment, is that you're seeing the average is rolling over time. And so you're getting a new number in and an old number out. But in that particular instance, what you are seeing is that we probably did overdraw the fund legitimately in 2021 just because the fund performed poorly and our draw rate was, even under current law, wasn't reacting to that reality.
Follow up?
Representative Gray.
So I'll ask a second question about this. So the part, can you explain a little bit about, I feel like the 20-year average should be more stable, I guess more consistent, but actually the red line looks a little straighter. So, in my non-economist brain, why does the green line feel a little bit more volatile than the red line?
Representative Gray, through the chair, it's a good question. So what's happening is that when you have a fixed rate of return, or I'm sorry, a fixed percent market draw like we have now, the 5% draw, its only volatility is based on the balance of the fund. And so you're seeing a little bit of wiggle based on the balance of the funds. And the balance of the fund also has a smoothing effect. It's a 5-year average. And that's why that line does look a lot straighter. You notice there is still volatility, but it's a lot less. The average rate of return over the last 20 years is adaptive to a market that is very, very volatile. Going from plus 30% to minus 20% is a very volatile system. And because of that, even with a 20-year smoothing, you do still see quite a bit of volatility. But that is the trade-off that you're making to have a value that is tracking market performance. You could go longer, it would smoothen the curve further, or you could track the market more in real time, and it would become more volatile. The point is that you have to choose as a legislature to have a fixed number that we don't know is right, or to absorb the volatility that is inherent to the market and have a number that adjusts to it.
Follow up?
Representative Gray.
I personally like this bill because it means that we'll have more money to spend I mean, and I like that. But I know that we've seen a lot of modeling that shows that, you know, when we're basing a lot of our revenue on oil, and, you know, oil revenues are like this, that there is something comforting about seeing that red line as being fairly stable. I also know, I mean, I heard in parts of the presentation, you know, that basically we've been spending less. We've been taking out less than we had to. We've been putting more into the ERA than we had to, that we've been doing very, you know, what someone from the outside would say is fiscally conservative things that we didn't have to do. Like I said, I like this bill. I'm surprised, considering that it's going to give us more money to spend, that it's going to put less money in savings. I'm just a little bit surprised that that's what we're going to do. I mean, like I said, I'm not judging it.
If I can respond. Mr. Chair and Representative Gray through the chair. The first point I would make is that it's not necessarily true that we do get to access more money. In the past, the returns on the fund have been very high compared to what our expectations are for the future. And so when we look at the future, let me go to slide right here. So what you'll notice is on the left side, the draw in current year, 2024, is in fact higher because of the performance of the last 20 years. But in 2025, the draw is actually less. And that's because the current year that we're in today and the year prior was a high inflation and a zero to negative return. And so what you're seeing is that the draw amount is actually adjusting to that reality in real time. And so it's saying, hey, if you can kind of anthropomorphize, I suppose, the perma fund, it's saying, hey, you need to watch out. The fund hasn't performed the way that it should be, and you might not want to spend as much as you can.
Follow up. So if we're doing a five-year, currently doing a five-year, I would feel like a five-year would be even more influenced by the poor performance of the market in the last 2 years. And so, I mean, can you explain to me, as you would to a fifth grader, how if two out of the last 5 years are bad, whereas two out of the last 20 years are bad, why there's a bigger change in the green line than the black line?
Representative Gray, through the chair, I believe that your reference to the five-year is the current law. Mm-hmm. So the current law is 5% of the average market value of the funds, whereas what this bill is proposing is that the POMV itself is the 20-year average of the returns of the funds. So it's not an apples to apples.
Gotcha. So if the permanent fund's value didn't change that much, even if the market did badly, then the amount that we take doesn't really change that much either.
That is correct, Representative. In fact, if the POMV is drawing the entire rate of return that's being earned, then the number would be completely static.
So, again, if it's okay, follow up through the chair. On this slide, I understand what you mean. I mean, I have an understanding. But I did get just, you know, if we go, I guess, it's really slide 8. And I know that slide 8 is not looking forward, it's looking backwards. But it seems like most of the time, with the average real return, we would have taken a bigger draw. And it, like, 2012, 2013, 2014, 2015, 2016, 2017, 2018, 2019. You know, there's that one little pace where we didn't, and then a lot more in 22, 2023, 2024. So I understand that it may not be more money all the time, but am I right to assume that often we could expect, or more than 50% of the time, we could expect more money to spend if the market is performing well?
Representative Gray, through the chair, I'll try to answer that question twice in different ways. So first, if the future performance of the fund looks like the past performance, then yes. Because the fund is performing above that 5% number, then the sustainable draw from the fund is also above that 5% number. That would be true. You had another point. You had another question, and I completely lost it now. But I think that answers that part of your question.
It does. I think that's enough from me for right now.
Representative McKay.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Do you remember what it is that you wanted to say, Mr. King?
I do remember. So, Mr.
I'll go ahead and allow you to respond.
No, finish.
While the thoughts on your head.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The other point that I would make is that there is risk associated with having the fixed draw. And so if the actual performance of the fund going forward is lower, like it has been, you can see that it has been trending downward, then there is a risk that that number is too high. There is also a risk that it's too low if we do overperform. And the consequence of that is a policy decision for the legislature on whether it makes more sense to you all to grow our savings account or to fund education or other budget items. That's a policy decision.
Representative McKay.
Okay, thank you through the chair. Mr. King, thank you very much, of course. I'm going to try to package my questions so that they make sense. We passed, we could stay on slide 8. Or what year did SB 26 pass? You said the 28th legislature, but I didn't go back in
2018. Mr. Chairman, it took effect in 2018.
All right, so... So we started doing the 5% PUMV draws in 2018. We didn't do draws before 2018 because we had a lot of money. We had other savings accounts. So for the purposes of, I guess, our conversation, time started in 2018. Is that safe to say that?
Mr. Chairman,
that makes sense?
Yes.
So that's one thing to remember is this exercise kind of started in 18. So the conversations that were taking place when SB 26 was passed and put in place, it sounds like there were two alternatives, maybe more than two. The law that we have now under SB 26 and then your real POMV idea, and were those the two choices?
Representative McKay.
That makes sense?
Through the chair. Yes, I understand the question. The discussion, and I believe Representative Carpenter, you were there at the time, if I remember correctly. There was a lot of conversation around what the appropriate draw number would be. There was conversation around it being 5.25%, 5.5%, 6%, 4.5%. There were all kinds of numbers that were being thrown around. The legislature landed on the 5% number. There was not, to my recognition, a conversation around an adjustable rate. I don't remember that conversation.
So they decided to go with 5, and then they decided to do the 5-year averaging to give you like a softening. And those are the two main components, I guess, of SB 26. So it looks to me like that was the more conservative approach that would result in lower draws and more inflation proofing, which would be make sense, right? You might, if you were conservative, you would pick the more conservative approach. The other thing is, I remember when we got talking about all this was, well, we did it that way because that's how typical annuity funds, typical endowment funds are managed. Do you remember that? Can you?
Representative.
Am I making sense?
Hey, through the chair. I've heard the talking point. I'm not sure that it's rooted in reality. The spending rules for endowments across the world vary very widely.
Okay.
There are plenty of endowments that draw based on need, and then the need is limited by a POMV, but it's not based on a POMV. Okay. There's many different spending rules. The point is always that the kind of national standard is that 7% is the maximum sustainable draw on an endowment. Nationally, that's kind of, or internationally, really, that's kind of the prudent endowment model.
So Oh, gosh. It's easy to lose your train of thought and all this stuff. So if your proposal was in place today, the real PMV, if this law was in place today, how much less would our deficit be? Because right now we're just shy of $600 million on the House budget, right? Everybody agrees? It's like 578 or something. So if this was in place, would we be less? Would there be a less deficit?
Mr.
Do we have any idea how much?
Representative McKee through the chair. Yes, there would be a smaller deficit. It's a little bit complicated because let me just say this. It would be about a $500 or $600 million addition to the budget in this fiscal year. But depending on how this year plays out will determine what the draw will be next year. And it could very well be the case that the draw next year would increase that deficit because you're being more responsible and adjusting. If the market really does perform and inflation does stay as high as it is, that would be the consequence. You can see there that if you do get a 7% return next year, it does return to kind of that same sort of a number. There is a little bit of a complication, and that is that if the POMV were to go up in this case and your PFD draw is half of the POMV, now your numbers start to play a little bit. So you don't quite close the gap completely if you're going to increase the PFD amount based on the higher draw.
I just want to make sure we heard that number that you said about 30 seconds ago. You said that we'd have $500 or $600 million more dollars to spend, which is basically no deficit or darn close to it.
Mr. Chairman, I
don't want to. I mean,
a hard number right now, but I believe. I mean, it is the.
I mean, it's just fascinating to know that. I guess that. So some of our pain is self-inflicted because of the way we chose to set up SB 26.
That's a fair statement, Representative McKay.
Okay. Maybe I better quit while I'm ahead here, but okay, I'll maybe come back if we.
Representative McKay.
I better. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Gray.
Thanks. So I share Representative McKay's I don't know, relief. But I also heard you say that next year it would look very different. And, you know, the black lines are pretty stable and predictable, and the green lines are not. And so my fear is, as much as I would love to have an additional $600 million right now, that switching to this would take away some of the certainty that the original POMV formula gave us for our budget and would sort of add a layer of chaos that might rival what we have with oil revenues.
Representative Gray through the chair. Yeah. Yes, so two kind of points, I guess. First, I would say that the additional revenue that's coming from the earnings reserve in this analysis backs out the draw from the CBR. And so one could argue that it's more appropriate in the next year to make the CBR draw. That is what the stabilization fund is for in order. So you're really just moving the money around in that case. So it doesn't really add to the problem as much as it changes the way that you solve it. The other point that I would make is that yes, there is more volatility in this. That is the price that you pay for having something that adjusts to the market conditions. We have that exact same problem with oil revenue, and the way that you should be managing, or the way that an entity would manage that type of volatility, is through a stabilization fund. And that would, in your case, as the legislature, the most prudent way I could imagine that happening is that you would put a mechanism in place that would prevent you from spending money when revenues are high. And that way those savings are available when revenues are low. That's how you would deal with that volatility. And you would want that to apply not just to your earnings revenues, but also to your oil revenues. And that would not be difficult to design such a structure.
So if I might ask a question, do you spell stabilization fund CBR?
I do, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
I thought of another one.
Representative McKay.
Oh, okay. Let's Thank you, through the chairman. Inflation proofing. Mr. King and I have had private conversations about some of this, and I remember being told that, for example, we've deposited almost $9 billion in the corpus in the last 2 years, voluntarily, in the name of inflation proofing. We've done that. So we've taken that money off the table for our budget. So I think that I heard it said that we don't have to do that and that the fund inflation proofs itself. And I will confess immediately, I don't understand that at all. But maybe you could explain that at the farmer level. We're all farm boys it's at heart, you know.
It's okay. Representative or Mr. King.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The inflation proofing question, so you asked two questions about inflation proofing. One about the movement of inflation proofing from the earnings reserve to the principal account. So I'll address that first. The earnings reserve account is by definition earnings of the fund, and therefore they are accessible by the Constitution to the legislature. They are available and accessible. If the legislature wanted to take that money away from itself because it didn't trust itself to not spend that money, one way that you could do that is to put it into the principal account. The double-edged sword, though, is that now that money is not accessible if market conditions deteriorate. And so you always have this trade-off between that money being accessible being a good thing and accessible being a bad thing. Mm-hmm. In terms of volatility stabilization, you need to have some balance in a fund that you can access when the market conditions deteriorate, whether that's the oil market or the earnings market or the stock market or both. And those two volatility revenues, those two volatile revenue streams should be able to offset one another. So when the oil prices are down, you should be able to draw more off of your earnings. And when the earnings are down, you should be able to draw more off of your other reserves. Those two things, if the state was managing its portfolio wholly, you would do that through not an earnings reserve with a POMV, but through some other mechanism that forces you to save money when the markets are what performing well. HDR2 is an example of that. The point there, though, is that the stabilization, the inflation proofing is not actually inflation proofing. The transfer from the earnings reserve to the principal account, which we call inflation proofing, it's not actually inflation proofing in the way that the POMV contemplates it. In the past, when the earnings reserve account was primarily used as a undistributed earnings for the dividend, that was its primary purpose, the fund didn't need to hold additional.
And that's the original statute.
That is correct, Mr.
That's the original PFD statute, was the earnings was the source of the PFD.
Representative McKinney, that is correct.
I think it's important to know that.
Yes. And in that regard, because you didn't have any mechanism to save money in the earnings reserve, because the money was being distributed to the people through the dividend, there was a mechanism in place to inflation proof the principal. The ERA itself was not, even though it was attached to the permanent fund, it wasn't considered to be a sub account of the fund in the way that the principal is. It wasn't intended to be saved. It was intended to be distributed in the future. And so you had to have a mechanism where you were inflation proofing the principal. When we get to the POMV, though, the 5% number or the proposed option here, in either case, you're accounting for inflation in your draw amount. So the 5% number says that we expect actual returns to be 7.5%. We expect inflation to be 2.5%. Therefore, you can draw 5%. That's the thinking. And so because that 2.5% isn't drawn, it's remaining in the fund. If you think of the permanent fund as both the principal and as the earnings reserve combined, that POMV structure forces inflation proofing, but it forces it to stay in the earnings reserve. The transfers between the principal and the earnings reserve are completely voluntary. Inflation proofing happens whether you make that transfer or not. The only question that you have is whether you want that money to be accessible to the legislature or not.
So I remember we were doing inflation proofing back in the 90s. And everybody, I think, thought it was this great, noble thing to do. And, of course, it sounds good. I think most Alaskans were, yeah, great, we should be doing that. But effectively, we were double dipping on inflation proofing when we didn't have to. We were just trying to build up the corpus.
Representative McKay.
In anticipation of someday we might need it.
We might want to reference the statute at this point. If we're looking back prior to SB 26, there is a statutory requirement that still is on the books, actually, to inflation proof.
Okay.
And along with the 21% of net earnings, 50% draw to the dividend fund.
I want to say the statute is 3717-145C, if I can remember correctly. Mr. Chairman, and it was the case that in the 90s when the conversation around, or even in the 80s when the conversation around inflation proofing was going on, there was this recognition that we still had a lot of oil to produce. Mm-hmm. As we get closer to lower and lower levels of production, at some point you need to transition away from growing the fund and into using the fund. We've started that process in 2018 with the POMV. And so now the question becomes, do we continue to try to grow the fund, or do we try to establish a structure that allows that fund to continue throughout the future, but still make other arrangements to fund the government? So it's mostly a question of how you want the government to be structured, whether you want it to be completely run by a trust fund, in which case you need a tax now in order to build up the fund large enough, or do you want the fund to be smaller and have a future tax to make up that difference? That's a policy call that the legislature will have to make.
Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair. So what I hear now is that, yes, we might be able to pull more money, or it'll be a bigger percentage of the draw if we're using the real formula. I'll call it the real formula. But we'll have a spending cap, so we wouldn't be able to spend that money. So we would it be your, that money would get saved for the next year when it's down. So to me, then, from my perspective, as somebody who wants to, you know, currently our current budget is above the proposed statutory spending cap. So even though we would be plugging it, you know, we're already above the spending limit. So I just feel I would support this if it meant that we had money that we could use. But if we're just taking it out so that we can put it somewhere else, like you said, it's just moving money around. So am I understanding it correctly that if we have the spending cap in place, that's the current bill for the statutory spending cap that we have that we're considering, then it really doesn't matter because we might be pulling more money off, but we won't be able to use it.
Representative Gray, through the chair, that's a very good observation. So if the legislature were to enforce a spending limit and it were in effect in such a way that it was actually used and followed, so it was limiting spending, then the result would be that when you have either higher earnings or higher oil revenues, you couldn't spend that extra money. You'd have to save it. In that case, you no longer need a POMV at all.
Because your 5% is more than...
The 5% would be...
Exceeds your spending caps.
Representing the K through the...
Sorry.
In that situation, if the 5% POMV were to stay in effect and the spending cap were also to take effect, you do run into a problem where there can be low oil revenue years where there's not enough balance in the CBR to balance the budget, but there would be money in the ERA that could balance the budget, but we wouldn't be allowed to use it. And so you create this artificial problem where you have the money, but you're not allowed to spend it. My suggestion would be if you were to pass a spending limit that was effective, you don't need this bill or the POMV. You should repeal the POMV.
Why don't you explain that for people who don't get it?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, the point being that the POMV is in place in order to limit the amount of money that the legislature can spend. In effect, it is a spending limit, but it's only limiting the spending from the earnings of the permanent fund, right? In a situation where you had a spending limit in place, it could serve as that POMV draw. But it would also allow, if you were to get rid of that POMV, it would also allow excess earnings to backfill low oil years and vice versa. And so it would be very unusual for you to have a spending limit and then also a POMV limit, as long as you're not allowed to invade the principal of the fund, which our Constitution prevents. You do not need a POMV if you have a spending limit.
In effect, your stabilization fund is either the CVR or the earnings reserve account at that point.
That is correct.
Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair, I appreciate that because I have heard people say that the POMV functions as a spending limit. And it seems like what this bill does is raise that spending limit in years where the market has performed well. And I would support that. Thank you.
Questions?
I would like to,
Representative McKay.
If, you know, Mr. Chairman, you know, we get a little bit far afield sometimes in here, but I think it's healthy. So, Mr. King, you and I have discussed on various occasions, and I've made comments about how you actually don't want the permanent fund corpus to get too big, because it drives you away from needing a vibrant private sector. So there is some logic, maybe not everyone would agree, but there is some logic to the fact that we should be using more of the permanent fund to get us through these times, because if we're just focused on making the corpus bigger and bigger and bigger, then it's not a healthy capitalist economy to have a very weak private sector. Maybe you're an expert. Maybe you could explain that more better than I can.
Representative McKay, through the chair, I'm going to tread carefully. There are a couple of points that come to mind. I would say first the point that the fund, we shouldn't be necessarily trying to grow the fund. To that point, I would say there was a time when we had surplus revenues and it did make more sense for us to save money rather than spend it. That was the case. The question before you now is whether that's still the case. And I would posit that if you're saving excess earnings from the earnings reserve or from the oil industry, wherever those revenues are coming from, if they're excess to what the government needs, they should be saved. However, I wouldn't, as an economist, I wouldn't suggest that you take money out of the private sector in order to grow a savings account. So it makes a lot more sense to save money when it's surplus. It makes a lot less sense to save money when it's coming from the economy. That's really the choice that needs to be made in the situation that you're describing. In the future, or when we contemplate the future, we can contemplate two futures. We can either contemplate a future where the permanent fund is large enough to support the entire government, in which case no tax would be necessary. And in fact, the private sector would not need to support the government. In fact, growing the private sector would be potentially a detriment to the government, as it would then have additional expenditures that it would be required to make. And so there is an argument that could make in that scenario where you have a trust fund that's large enough to support the entire public sector, it puts the public and private sector in conflict. The other alternative future is one where there is a permanent fund that's supporting stable baseline government, but then the private sector itself is supporting the rest of the government expenditures. In that case, the government and the private sector and the public sector are working in tandem. Public sector is providing infrastructure and services to the private sector. The private sector is providing revenues to the government. That's how a normal government works. It's a different world when you think about those two different futures. And the last point I would just make on that topic is that you can't just ask which one I would prefer. You also have to ask, what sacrifices do I have to make to get there? And if the sacrifice that you have to make in order to get to a trust fund that's able to fully support the government is that you're taxing and injuring the current economy in order to avoid taxes in the future. That's not any more intergenerationally equitable than doing the opposite, where we're just drawing down the fund recklessly and leaving the future generations to fend for themselves. It's that give and take is at the crux of the decisions that you are making in your fiscal plan discussions.
So to put it in real terms, if we were to do an income tax, a sales tax, a S-corp tax, and a per barrel credit reduction, which are all on the table, you know, we saw them today at lunchtime. At the same time that we're not drawing enough by using SB 26, then we're hurting our private sector to keep the permanent fund at a higher level of value than it needs to be. So we're gonna, if we instituted any of those four taxes or all of them, we would be doing exactly what you just described. We'd be taken from the private sector to artificially keep the permanent fund higher than it needs to be.
Representative McKay, through the chair.
Okay.
The words that you're using are a little stronger than the words that I would use. I believe that your point is valid, that it is a decision that the legislature has to make. If it wants to grow the permanent fund, it has to ask itself at what cost and whether that cost is one that the legislature is willing to pay. The people are willing to pay, right? Whether that's a tax now or whether that's a tax in the future. A good fiscal, long-term fiscal plan would balance those impacts between the current generation and the future. And so you certainly can run into a situation where it is injurious to the current generation in order to make life easier in the future. It's also possible to do the opposite and not take enough action today and then just leaving the future generations to fend for themselves. So that balancing act is a very tenuous one. And because we can't know what the future looks like, it's a very difficult decision to make. That is precisely why you need a structure that automatically adjusts to what's going on in the markets.
I'm going to chime in here for just a second, just some general observations. The permanent fund dividend program was not created at the inception of the permanent fund. We created it later. Mm-hmm. When we created the permanent fund, the purpose of the fund was one thing and one thing only, to grow. So the legislature's role, to the extent that it had a role, was to just ensure that that fund grows. And at some point in time, we made a decision that said, okay, let's start drawing a little bit of money from the fund, and we're going to do something with it to keep people engaged and care about the fund growth. And that was the birth of the permanent fund dividend program and the in statute. And also at that time, probably the inflation proofing piece of this too, because prior to that, there was no draw happening. There was no need for inflation proofing. At a certain time later here, 2018, we now change from the model that we were using for several decades to a percent of market value draw. And the purpose of that was to adjust how much we're taking out of the fund and the mechanism by how we are drawing it out to stabilize that amount. And the purpose being that we wanted a more stable, non-cyclical oil revenue. We wanted more stable revenue for state government. And so forward to this year and the last few years, we've been fighting over the balance between paying a dividend and funding state government from that more stable source, which we see on the previous line on slide 8, which is the red line, right? And so the question becomes, if we are talking about taxation in order to balance our spending at the same time that we're drawing money out of the fund, in order to grow the fund, a legitimate question that we have to ask is, what is the purpose of the fund? Is it still to grow? And if it is, to what extent? To what level? When is enough enough? If it isn't to grow and the purpose of the fund is now to provide revenue to the state, then what is the appropriate amount of revenue, given that we always want to have revenue coming in from the fund, meaning we don't want to take too much out that causes the fund to balance to decline and we have declining revenues. To me, that seems like the underlying question that we haven't really solved yet within the legislature, within the different pushes and pulls of fighting over money. And that's kind of the quintessential problem that we haven't quite solved yet, is a structure that balances the question or solves that question. What is the purpose of the fund? And do we need private sector revenue to pay for state government? Because as you pointed out, Representative McKay, if we're going to tax people in order to pay for state services that enable us to keep growing the permanent fund, it seems like a wrong thing to do for current generations. Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair, I appreciate what you're saying. I think the most difficult thing for humans to do is to not do what's best in this moment, but to think about what's best for your grandchildren or great-grandchildren or people that you're not going to meet. And my understanding is that we will run out of oil revenue at some point. At some point that we will run out and we won't have that revenue coming in. And so my understanding is that we preserve the permanent fund so that there's always some form of money for the state that will be available forever. And the types of taxing that we're talking about, a 2% or 2% income tax or a 2% sales tax or even a 4% sales tax, we know that would still put us as one of the smallest tax states in the nation. And my hope would be that we are able to continue forever as one of the smallest taxed states in the nation because we preserve the permanent fund. I think the easy thing would be to be like, well, I mean, to paraphrase what someone said on the floor once, is that scarcity breeds innovation. We'll spend the whole permanent fund and then we'll figure it out. But my fear would be is that we would, if that were to happen, that in order for Alaska to continue, we would have to be one of the highest tax states. And that there would just be, if we had no permanent fund and no oil revenue, that we would be in very big trouble, and we don't want to be in very big trouble, even if we're not alive to see it. So I appreciate that our legislature has put so much extra money away, didn't spend it. We made good decisions without a cap in place. We made responsible decisions. And as much as I love the idea that we could easily solve the plan by changing the formula and getting a bigger draw this year, I just wouldn't want to do it at the expense of, cursing our grandchildren to being in the highest state, tax state in the country.
As we saw today at lunch, a couple of years from now, you may have to do it because there won't be anything in the CBR. It'll be empty.
Hopefully we'll still have $80 billion or more.
But if your CBR is empty, and you're in deficit, you got to get it from, you're going to have to get it. Anyway.
Your point's very valid. If we do draw all of our available reserves down to zero and we still need more, then the question becomes, what does the state's responsibility have to the current generation? And we have funds available. They are in other funds that aren't general funds or CBR or ERA. They're the education fund. They're corporations that we've funded and have balances. There's still money that we can go after, that the legislature would be obligated to go after. Any available source to balance a budget is what we would be constitutionally required to do. And I would think that at some point in time might come up, this is maybe down the road, but the permanent fund corpus would be on the list at some point in time. Representative Groh.
I'm impressed, Mr. Chairman, by the progress we have made. The progress that you've led us toward. First of all, I appreciate that it's now accepted that Alaskans are the lowest tax people in the United States, as was shown last night. There was earlier some disagreement about that, but that's just clearly true. Now, that might change, as Representative McKay might change, as pointed out. And I also want to go back, and I think you've helped us go back to an earlier discussion we've had that I brought out about the eras in Alaska fiscal policy. Not to brag, I guess the most chronologically advantaged person in the room as I look around, and someone who was born in the territory of Alaska. When I was born, it was shortly after the territory of Alaska adopted the income tax in 1949. That became the mainstay of finance for the state for decades until the big oil money started to come in. On this graphic, although it's made by Mr. King for a different purpose, 2015 is about the year the system, it became obvious the old oil tax, an oil royalty system living off oil money for the state, so it became obvious it was broken. And it took another 3 years or so until 2018 when we adopted this legislature adopted the POMV system, so then we now have oil plus POMV, as I have said, and as the economist from the Department of Labor acknowledged.
But that was driven by the Supreme Court decision on the PFT, right?
Well, no, the bigger sort of bigger
issue. That happened in 16, Walker.
Well, no, the bigger issue was in 2015.
I'm sorry.
You recognized that the way of getting, of paying for everything, that both the government, the conventional public services, roads, schools, ferries, troopers, and the dividends out of oil money exclusively no longer worked, right? And so then
a decision was made to some
Governor Walker took here. One of the approaches, which was to try to.
Let me time out for just a second.
Sorry.
I'm okay with the dialogue, but we're going to have to be careful with the recorders.
Sorry.
Right. They're not going to be able to tell who's speaking. So,
well,
let me maintain that control.
Thank you, Mr.
Representative Groh.
I'm the one with the deeper voice. So it's to make it easier. But I do think another I have given many speeches and presentations all around Alaska about this. Remember, back when I used to do this gig for free, as I said. And I would frequently say, the two most important questions in Alaska, and they still are. Number one is, what is the permanent fund for? And that, and I say, not what is the permanent fund dividend for, but it's the chairman is pointing out, what is the permanent fund for? And the second question is, and I think it is still relevant when I first started posing it, so relevant now, is how long do you individually plan to stay in Alaska? And that is not a question of how long you've lived here, whether it's all your life like me or shorter periods like some other people, but more looking forward, not retrospectively, but forward. How long prospectively do you intend to live here? If you think you're going to be living in a condominium in Palm Springs in the year 2026, I do not think that you're going to be big on sacrifices now to make the state of Alaska a better place in 2028. And I frequently said that one of Alaska's biggest problems that I've observed is a number of the more powerful people in Alaska, like a lot of others who are not so powerful, plan to leave the state soon. And I think that is something that's got to be directly confronted. And it's hard to measure. You don't walk around wearing a sign on your face or on the top of your head saying, I'm out of here in June of 2026, as soon as the school year ends. But I do think that that's a very important and relevant consideration. We talked about increasing the population, or at least reversing the migration. But I do think that we also have to focus on the fact that a number of people do want to be part of that out-migration.
Representative McKay, I kind of squashed the conversation a minute ago, so I'll give you an opportunity.
Well, I thought I would ask Mr. King about your, just so it's on the record and everybody hears it that's on the panel, about how what can happen when the CBR is empty and we are allowed to transfer money from the Permanent Fund Earnings Reserve into the CBR with a majority vote. And I'll let you finish the sentence, but I don't want to say it because I'm not the expert, but I know you are. So let's do that.
Representative McKay, through the chair, I believe what you might be referencing is the clause within the Constitution that allows a draw from this constitutional budget reserve with a majority vote. Is that correct?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, the two ways that money can be drawn from the CBR, either through Provision B or Provision C. Provision C is the three-quarter vote that you all are very familiar with. Provision B is one that we've never actually used because we've always had accessible revenues within the earnings reserve, so that provision is never triggered. The trigger occurs when you don't have enough revenues to pay for your full budget that you passed the year before. And in that case, you could draw off the CBR with just a simple majority vote. I believe that might be what you're referencing.
Yeah, and I guess I wanted to mention that and point it out to the group here because through the chair, I'm sorry, McKay here, so that there is a mechanism where if you're in deficit on your budget and your CBR is zero, you can refill the CBR and then use it to balance your budget with a majority vote.
Representative McKay, through the chair, I would just point out that is correct. And in the 1990s, when the CBR was Constitution Amendment was passed, the effect of those two provisions is that there is a spending limit in place that does restrict the money from the legislature's hands. So in the same way that you're contemplating a spending limit now, where you can't go above a certain limit without an additional vote, that's what the CBR naturally does. But by holding the money in the CBR rather than the earnings reserve, if that money is intended to be used as a stabilizing mechanism, those mechanisms are already in place. You don't need additional legislation. The choice that the legislature has to make is whether the earnings in the earnings reserve are part of the permit fund in the way that we think about the permit fund, the principle of the fund, that it's off limits. And the vernacular, even in this discussion, when we talk about taking money out of the earnings reserve, the talking point is often that it's a draw on our savings. That is actually not accurate because the earnings reserve account is full of earnings. Those are, by constitution, general fund monies, right? And they're put into the earnings reserve by statute, but they are still revenues that are available to the state. The POMV law, SB 26, was passed in 2018, and the bill that we're speaking about now doesn't give you permission to access the earnings reserve. It limits how much money you can access. It doesn't give you permission to access. It limits how much you can. And so the conversation around the earnings reserve gets a little bit misleading in the common dialogue because of that fact. The principle of the permanent fund is protected by the Constitution. It cannot be invaded without a constitutional amendment. And for that reason, the question before the legislature is, do we want to apply those same protections to the balances currently in the earnings reserve? Do we view those as money that is off limits, or do we view those as monies that are available to deal with our budget situations? That's a policy decision that the legislature can make.
Follow up?
Representative McKay.
Okay. I would like to know what, and I've mentioned this before, you know, the country of Norway has approaching $1 trillion in their sovereign wealth fund. They do not pay dividends. They have high taxes, or relatively high taxes, and they're still producing oil and gas. You don't see the Norwegians shutting in any platforms because of the climate crisis. I would like to know what they plan to do, or if they even know, or how much do they draw from their sovereign wealth fund to fund government. Is the country of Norway now, and I lived there for 4 years, so I got pretty familiar with, are they at the point now like we are where not all of their government is funded by oil and gas production? And don't expect an answer to that. I'd like to know that also for Alberta. I understand Alberta has some sort of sovereign wealth fund. How are they managing their situation? I think it would be interesting for our group to look at peer, you know, we look at other states, but we're not like other states, really. We're like some other countries. We're like Saudi Arabia. We're like Norway. We're like Alberta. You know, or provinces, but maybe it would be instructive to see how they're handling these types of problems. I just offer that.
Mr. King, I won't require you to opine about Norway. Representative McKay might be the subject matter expert, having lived there longer than you have. Anyway.
Just curious how they're managing their, how Saudi Arabia do, you know.
I have a comment, but Representative Groh, go ahead.
I'm Representative Cliff Groh, the man who's never lived in Norway, but I've had coffee with people who've traveled there and read about it. And what I've always understood, or at least in, you know, when I've looked at it, Norway is different in at least five ways. Representative McKay has listed some. They have always had higher taxes than existed in Alaska or generally in the United States. They have a higher take. Whether you call it oil taxes or oil royalties, the government take from oil production in Norway, I understand, is higher than Alaska has had. So that they've gotten a larger share of revenues from the production of oil there. Number three, the government of Norway has traditionally taken more risk than the state of Alaska has. I'll say on the record, I urge the state of Alaska to consider starting the state of Alaska a state oil company. That didn't occur, right? I was, you know, and that never happened. I think that's unlikely now. But for a long time, the government of Norway had its own state oil company. I don't know if it does now.
I think the point's made that Norway does things differently than the United States.
No dividends in their own country. They obviously do control their borders. And to answer the question about Alberta, which I've watched over a long period of time, it was famous and notorious that Alberta had engaged in social investments, and their fund had ran into substantial troubles because of that. That the state of Alaska worked hard to avoid with the permanent fund. That's my, you know, history lesson that I would offer from decades.
Thank you, Representative Groh. I would like to circle us around to kind of the value of the conversation that we've had here. Kind of challenges the paradigm by which we've come to believe for where we're at right now, right? We're having a conversation about how do we solve a budget deficit in the current year and have to keep in mind future generations. Current model of 5% of the market value has a purpose. Is it the right purpose for the choices that we have before us? That's a question that we need to grapple with. Are we going to tax in order to fill our deficit? Are we going to reduce spending? These are all of the levers that we have to consider. And the value of what we're talking about now is if you're going to pull money out of the permanent fund, is it going to be for government services only? Or is it going to be for private sector business investment, people spending in the private sector, that type of thing? That's really the question that's before us, largely, that we have to solve the problem with. And the models that are being presented are range anywhere from a 25-75 split to a 50-50 split, or maybe the conversation ends up with somewhere in the middle, right, for compromise sake, if we can't agree on one or the other. But either way of those two things, you still have the question, what is the purpose of the fund? And are we looking to get to a place where our government is completely funded by the permanent fund earnings? Is that what we want into the future? Or are we looking at there's value in having a private sector economy tied into the state government because we want good jobs within our state? If we don't have a need for tax revenue from the private sector, because the permanent fund earnings is paying for all of our state government, then the decisions we make in this body don't really matter to growth of the economy where most Alaskans live and work. So the structural problem, the question that we need to grapple with is, if we're wanting economic growth that supports local government, that supports our schools, that supports education, that supports roads and road maintenance at the local level, that economic growth is what's going to enable that to happen. Or we're just going to make a decision that goes the route of Norway and fund our government off of the permanent fund. that's kind of a decision that we're being faced with long term.
Sure. Norway has not done that. They have all kinds of taxes.
I'm not disagreeing with that.
Okay, just want to make that point.
I'm just saying that they're funding. They don't have a dividend from their sovereign wealth fund.
No,
they are using it for government purposes, and they have taxes for government services. Right? That's what I'm trying to get at. Okay, Representative King or Mr. King.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You can have the last word tonight.
Appreciate it. I'd just like to offer two comments. One, Representative Gray made a comment about saving the money for the future, and I would say that we have successfully done that. There's about $60 billion, a little more than $60 billion in the principal of the permanent fund. That money is constitutionally protected and will be available to all future generations. I would also submit to the body that the growth of that fund when it was created was intended to save what we knew was temporary oil wealth and turn it into something that would last forever. And from that perspective, the idea of saving some of the royalties, 25% of the royalties, for into perpetuity makes a lot of sense. But what I would submit to you now is that what we're doing now to grow the fund is not saving oil wealth. It is saving earnings off of the fund. And it's a question for the population, it's a question for the legislature on whether that is the policy that the legislature wants to embark on, whether continuing to grow the fund, not to save oil wealth for the future, but to save earnings for the future. That's a policy decision that you all can make.
Thank you, Mr. King. All right. There's no other business to come before the committee, and I think we're exhausted the conversation for tonight. So we will be adjourned as of 7:29 p.m.